Ich bin Lucky Flickerman, allererster Moderator der Hungerspiele.
Genießen Sie die Show.
5, 4, 3, 2,
Genießen Sie die Show.
Lauf!
Genießen Sie die Show.
Deutschlandfunk Nova. Deine Podcasts. Eine Stunde Film.
Mit Anna Wollner.
Gelaufen ist in dieser Woche auch mein lieber Kollege, Freund und Co-Host von Eine Stunde Film. Ihr kennt ihn auch als Tom Westerholt. Also der ist in irgendwelche Viren gelaufen, denn leider hat es Tom in dieser Woche komplett zerfetzt. Irgendwas mit Grippe. So kaputt, dass er das Bett dem Studio vorzieht. Wobei Studio auch bei mir falsch ist, denn wie ihr vielleicht hört, bin ich nicht in Kreuzberg, sondern Achtung, ich mach mal kurz das Fenster auf. Ja genau, in Paris. Also wenn ihr das ja hört, werde ich Ridley Scott und Joaquin Phoenix getroffen haben werden in Paris zum Film Napoleon, passenderweise. Deswegen bin ich hier und produziere ausnahmsweise mal aus dem Kleiderschrank eines Hotelzimmers mitten in der Stadt im ersten Arrondissement. Also Entschuldigung, wenn zwischendurch mal eine Tür knallt oder eine Alarmanlage angeht. Es geht einfach nicht anders. Immerhin fast mit Blick auf die Champs-Élysées. Es muss ja auch was Gutes haben, aber dazu nächste Woche mehr. Diese Woche nehme ich euch mit nach Panem. Paris hat ja auch ein bisschen was vom Kapitol, wobei der Film in Berlin gedreht wurde. Ich spreche über die Tribute von Panem, The Ballad of Snowbirds and Snakes. Und Tom hat mit Regisseur Francis Lawrence, nicht verwandt mit Jennifer Lawrence, und mit Produzentin Nina Jacobsen gesprochen. Ich war dazu auch noch zweimal im Kino, in Cat Person und in The Quiet Girl, und habe zu ersterem auch mit der Regisseurin Susanna Vogel gesprochen. Aber erstmal ab nach Panem.
Wir sind live.
Immer lächeln. Dafür haben wir Zähne.
Stell dir vor, es wäre dein Name gezogen worden. Ich würde wissen wollen, dass ich irgendwem wichtig bin. Dass ich noch wertvoll bin.
Willkommen im Kapitol.
Du solltest nicht hier sein, wie es scheint.
Sollte ich auch nichts. Aber ich bin dein Mentor.
Ein Rebell.
8 Jahre ist es her, dass die unter anderem auch in Berlin gedrehte Tribune von Panem-Trilogie mit dem 4. Teil, mit Mockingjay Teil 2, zu Ende gegangen ist. Eine Reihe, die ja die unter anderem Jennifer Lawrence zum Star gemacht hat. Ab Donnerstag jetzt die Vorgeschichte, ein Filmtitel, der ungefähr genauso lang ist wie auch der Film selbst. Die Tribute von Panem, The Ballad of Snowbirds and Snakes. Die Romanvorlage wieder von Suzanne Collins. Es ist ein bisschen dieser Star Wars-Kniff, ne? Das Prequel schlägt sich auf die dunkle Seite der Macht und erzählt den Aufstieg von Coriolanus Snow, den wir in der Panem-Reihe, gespielt von Donald Sutherland, ja als fiesen Präsidenten von Panem und auch Strippenzieher der Hunger Games kennengelernt haben. Hier jetzt, weil es so schön ist, sage ich es nochmal, The Ballad of Snowbirds and Snakes, sehen wir einen 18-jährigen Jungspund aus einer altehrwürdigen, stolzen Familie, die allerdings in Ungnade gefallen ist und der bei den 10. Hungerspielen zum Mentor wird.
Dieses Jahr gibt es eine Änderung. Ihre Aufgabe als Mentor, Mr. Snow, ist es, aus diesen Kindern Sensationen zu machen. Keine Überlebenden.
Was macht mein Mentor, außer mir Rosen zu bringen?
Ich gebe mir Mühe, dir den Rücken zu stärken.
Du willst mir in dieser Arena den Rücken stärken? Dann glaub erst mal daran, dass ich gewinne.
Da scheint dieses Perfide der Hungerspiele raus, was ja auch die Ursprungstrilogie hatte. Dieser perverse Kampf ums Überleben einiger zur Unterhaltung vieler. Mittendrin eben Snow, der seine Rolle, seinen moralischen Standpunkt noch finden muss. Wer natürlich Panem kennt, der weiß, für welche Seite er sich entscheidet. Das ist nicht unbedingt ein Spoiler. Vom Figurenaufbau schon spannend, aber irgendwie doch keine Katniss.
Mr. Snow, ich frage Sie ein allerletztes Mal. Was ist der Sinn und Zweck der Hungerspiele?
Gute Frage, nächste Frage. Der Film füllt eine Lücke, die ich ehrlicherweise nie hatte. Lawrence heißt in dem Fall tatsächlich nur der Regisseur, nicht mehr die Hauptdarstellerin, der hier seinen 4. Film der Reihe abliefert. Donald Sutherland in Jung wird von Newcomer Tom Blyth gespielt. Lucia Gray, die statt Pfeil und Bogen die Gitarre und ihre Stimme als Waffe hat, von Rachel Zegler. Die hat mich vor allem in West Side Story begeistert. Peter Dinklage macht das, was er immer macht. Er ist böse, er spielt den bösen Dekan. Jason Schwartzman, den Moderator Flickerman, quasi der Opa von Stanley Tucci, gefühlt. Viola Davis als Präsidentin, ihre Figur hat schon fast sowas Bond-Bösewicht-mäßiges. Alles in allem sind das solide schauspielerische Leistungen. Übrigens viele junge deutsche Schauspieler und Schauspielerinnen in Nebenrollen. Allerdings bleiben die alle sehr blass, weil es ein Problem des Films ist, sich zu sehr auf den Hauptkonflikt und die Hauptfigur zu konzentrieren. Gedreht, und deswegen auch die ganzen Deutschen, wieder in und um Berlin unter anderem. Szenenbildner Uli Hanisch, der hat sich am Berlin der 60er 60er Jahre orientiert. Immerhin ist das ja auch eine Zeitreise. Der Film spielt 64 Jahre vor der Haupttrilogie. Es ist alles so ein bisschen historisch. Das Olympiastadion als Außenfassade für die Gladiatorenarena, die Karl-Marx-Allee mitten in Berlin am Anfang als Schauplatz für die Zerstörung nach dem Aufstand der Distrikte. Die Teilnehmer, die werden unter anderem im Berliner Zoo in ein Gehege gefercht. Das hat schon Wiedererkennungswert. Aus der Warte macht es Spaß, Berlin mal in einem etwas anderen Look zu sehen. Aber ansonsten ist das so ein total zerfaserter Film, der zwar eine spannende, ambivalente, charismatische, böse Hauptfigur hat, aber einfach gemessen an den Hauptpaaren im Film an der nötigen Spannung scheitert. Tom hat vor der Grippe und vor Ende des Schauspielerstreiks den Lawrence getroffen, also den Francis Lawrence, und Nina Jacobsen, die Produzentin des Films.
At least we got one Lawrence to talk about another Hunger Games movie. It's not Jennifer this time, but it's Francis Lawrence, the director.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we have producer Nina Jacobsen. Good to have you guys. Hello.
Hey.
Hello.
Thank you.
When we met the last time, which was almost exactly 8 years ago, for the world premiere of Mockingjay Part 2 here in Berlin, little did we know that we would meet again for another Hunger Games movie, did we?
No, I think we all thought that that was going to be it. Yeah, Suzanne Collins had no plans for any other books. She'd been working on the past, you know, the books and movies for, I think, about 10 years. And so she was very ready to go and do some different things. I think we were all probably pretty ready to go and do some different things. But we also knew we were not going to do another movie unless it came from, you know, something that Suzanne wrote. So, yeah, very surprising to get the call that she had a new book in 2019, I think it was.
Yeah. So when the book came out, I understood you guys very quickly jumped on the train and said, okay, we want to do this one more time, right?
Yes, we got what was a surprise phone call, because we really weren't tracking that she was writing a book and a new book. And so we got the phone call. We went to the office of her agent and read the manuscript. It was during COVID, so you had to go into this little room. They give you snacks. You're by yourself, and you have like two sittings that you can, you know, sit down and read for 6 hours one day and then come back the next day and finish. And so for one, I think we were excited that after the first half, we were really didn't want to be put it down. You wanted to take it home with you and finish the book. And I think, you know, once we realized that, you know, we felt that we could go back without feeling like we were just doing the same thing. The time period is different, the games are different, and the characters, you know, there are the two characters who we know from the past movies, Snow and Tigress, but even what we know about them in this movie is completely different than what we knew about them before.
Yes.
And I think we felt like it was a great chance to come back to the world, and at the same time, felt like a completely sort of original movie, and a movie that could stand alone for people who've never seen the other films, that they would still find enough in this film maybe to make them want to see the others, but they wouldn't need to.
Exactly. But let's still address the two elephants in the room. The first one I would like to call the gamble to move on with a huge franchise like this, but having to deal right from the beginning with the facts that all the stars the fans know across the world from the first four movies won't be there. There is no Jennifer, there is no Josh, there is no Liam, there is no Donald, there is no Woody, there is no Elizabeth.
It's definitely a gamble. I mean, I think that I was probably more worried about it knowing that we were going to be reading a book that took place, you know, she said, I don't want to tell you the story. I'm just going to tell you it takes place 64 years before the first books. There's only one crossover character, really, she said, and there's a musical element. And so before having read it, I felt like it's a huge gamble to do, you know, a movie that, you know, that you have to build an entirely new cast. But I fell in love with the story. I fell in love with the origin story. I fell in love with what the story's about. And I liked the fresh take. It very much felt like it was part of the Hunger Games world. I thought fans would really love to sort of, you know, discover the origins of so many things. I certainly had that experience when I was reading the book. So the more I read the story, the less I worried about the gamble itself.
I would also say that from the beginning, these movies have been gambles. The first one, at the time that the original was made, common wisdom was that, a young female lead can't open a movie, especially in a genre like that. A Katniss Everdeen or Jennifer Lawrence, that, she became a huge name. She was already very accomplished as an actor. But the first one, we took a lot of risks. And I think that we were rewarded for gambling. Mm-hmm. And so had it not felt like a gamble, had it not felt like a risk, I don't think we would have been so excited to do it. And by the way, Suzanne wouldn't have written it. And certainly the first movie was a risk because a lot of people were like, nobody wants to see a movie about kids being forced to kill each other. But it is something that people clearly, it resonates with people. It speaks to the times that we're living in, that people actually do feel they identify with these characters. And so I think we would not have felt comfortable had it not felt like a gamble.
Yes. Second elephant in the room, I would say, is the situation that you do have stars in the movie, such as Jason Schwartzman, Peter Dinklage, or of course Viola Davis. But now situation has it that you are going around the world promoting a movie and you can bring these stars to the audiences because of SAG-AFTRA strike. You did get kind of an exception to bring some of the cast to Berlin. But how is that situation right now for you promoting a huge franchise like this?
Honestly, it's, when the strike was happening and we knew that there was going to be this chance that none of the actors were going to come, Lionsgate stood strong and stayed stuck to the release date. And honestly, for months, I think Nina and I thought we were going to be the only ones going to promote. So we were going to be traveling around, going to Berlin, going to London, LA, New York, whatever. And we thought we were going to be doing it on our own. So to now be joined by cast is phenomenal. And the truth is I'm honestly more excited for them. Mm-hmm. And what it means for them as actors and as friends and sort of part of our family.
To show their work.
Yeah, yes. To show their work and to be able to stand out kind of in front of the movie and what that can do for them. I think it's more important that that's happening than them out here selling our movie.
You said doing the Hunger Games movies was kind of a gamble and a risk right from the beginning. But meanwhile, we are four movies later and they have become a huge worldwide success. So in the end, I thought there is you too, Francis. You still had to provide although we don't have the stars from the original movies, and although thrilling screen experience, a thrilling adventure. And Nina, you at the end of the story, you had to provide success in a way. So I was asking myself how much strategy lies behind the creativity in this particular one.
I mean, I don't know that either one of us experiences it as strategy. I think we both have very similar styles, which is to work from the inside out. How do we create a story that serves the themes and the characters and the character dynamics that Suzanne gives us to work with? Our strategy is that then if we make a really good movie, people will go.
Yes, I think I agree. I just think it's like I fall in love with the story, and then it's you're just trying to figure out how to do it in the best way possible. Mm-hmm. That's kind of all there is. But there was no sort of strategizing on how to make it sort of fit into the world. It's really just, like, we love the story, we love what it's about, we love the themes, we love the characters, we love the challenge of trying to figure it out, but that's kind of it.
And otherwise, if it would work, then every movie would be a success, I guess.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
Exactly.
But what you did is you put some really fan-pleasing Easter eggs into the movie, which we, of course, didn't spoiler, and we won't do it now. How careful and yet celebrating did you have to deal with these? Like, not to overdose them, but make them recognizable.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, some of those ideas were in the book. And so I remember, you know, reading the manuscript for the first time and discovering the origins of certain things and just like having this sort of, you know, great moments of sort of revelation when you get to certain elements of the story. But then in the creation of the script and even in day-to-day shooting, we would like come up with ideas of just like even little things to add. One of the things that people picked up on very, very early with the trailer is that Lucy Gray, Rachel's character, does this sort of curtsy bow at the reaping. That's not in the book. That was not in the script. And it was something that I just told her that I thought she should try to do. But just because there's so many things like that in the story where you sort of feel this kind of historical significance, like if you were to go back to the movies. And so I just loved this idea that, you know, maybe Katniss Everdeen, who had done it in the first movie and the second movie, you know, maybe had heard that 64 years ago, there was a woman, a young woman who did this thing, sang this defiant song and did this sort of curtsy, you know, as an act of defiance. And I think people really loved that. And so that's just been a fun thing to try and find what like those moments could be, imagery and little pieces of behavior or hearing certain lines that, you know, connect to the other movies, things like that.
I mean, besides the fact that Rachel Zegler is a brilliant singer, which we all know at least since West Side Story, but did the fact that the Jennifer Lawrence version of The Hanging Tree became a huge radio success all over the world, did that have an impact on the fact that there is more singing in this one?
No, we got the book from Suzanne yeah. with the lyrics. All these songs
all in
are
there.
You know, she's written the lyrics. And by the way, we've had to make the songs much shorter. I mean, she wrote yeah. these amazing ballads and various kinds of songs that are, you know, it's all her lyrics. Dave Cobb, you know, put them to music. So we knew from the beginning, you know, that there would be this music. That did feel like a big gamble, though, for sure. It's yeah. such a departure. It's such an un-Katniss-like thing to do, to get up on stage and sing. But we knew from the beginning, yes, that's going to be one of the things that makes this movie so different than the rest. And we were very lucky to get, let's say, such a talented producer and Dave Cobb.
Absolutely, yeah. Talking about these balance between giving the fans a feeling that they might know, but also showing them something new. You could have, of course, have done more. You could have bring fans back to a District 12 that they already know, to sets they already know there. Maybe let Lucy Gray have a friend by the last name Everdeen, something like that. You could have done that in the movie. But you decided to shoot District 12 in the great Landschaftspark Nord in yes. Duisburg.
Yeah.
Why was that?
Well, very, very early on, you know, first of all, I love the world building part of making movies. I think that's really fun. So the idea of doing a period piece to the other movies was really exciting because it felt like I could sort of reinvent what Panem looks like. And we hired Uli Hanisch, the production designer, who's based locally here. He's amazing, very talented. And we did this research process. We knew we wanted to shoot in real locations. We did not want to do any real green screen work. And we went on sort of a hunt for where this arena could be, what could the locations be. I weirdly sort of already had in my head certain locations around here in Berlin that I was familiar with from the time we had spent here before. But after this short research period, we realized we found an arena in Poland, and the rest we found primarily in Berlin and then a little bit in Western Germany. And, you know, the truth is like when Uli took me to Duisburg, to the Landschaftspark, you know, I thought, man, if we had only had this location in the other movies, like we were in, you know, Atlanta, like, you know, my movies, we were in Atlanta for so long. And it was tricky. And here you have this incredible place. And this also never happens, is it's been made safe.
Yeah.
Like, there's no asbestos and chemicals and, you know, there's safe railings and everything because it's a park. So we could go in and sort of use it like a back lot, but it was such a huge space, incredible looking, but entirely accurate to what District 12 would be. And so I just love the idea that we could see a completely new version of District 12 and not have the same, you know, cement justice building that we've seen before. You know, that could have been built later. And so it was the same with Panem. It's like, you know, we're seeing a capital not long after a war. And so we looked a lot at like the Reconstruction era of Berlin and, you know, how you start to put the sort of classical buildings back together, how, when you start to construct the new buildings that aesthetically have a nod to the Panem that we're sort of familiar with. You know, it was just really fun to do all that with Uli.
Yeah, and Uli Hanisch is a dear friend of the show. We had him several times to talk about several sets that he designed. He made Cloud Atlas. He made Babylon Berlin, which was a huge thing in Germany.
That's why I hired him, was Babylon Berlin.
Yeah.
Nina, what would you say production-wise, what did he bring to the table that maybe hadn't been there before?
Well, I mean, the thing that was amazing for us, whether it is, you know, the Duisburg locations or, you know, the arena that we shot.
The snow apartment.
Yes, in Wrocław.
Which is really the only set.
That is our only built set. And so, but to get these practical locations, such a thrill for us, and to see how... say Uli and his team, like the detail that went into taking real locations that have this really, very relevant historical significance to the story and the themes. And then if you're, you know, from Berlin, from Germany, you might recognize those buildings yourself. And yet Uli plus our visual effects team, the way that those places are then sort of seamlessly integrated into Panem, both, you know, in the opening during the war, then later during the reconstruction when, you know, when Snow is 18, having, say, a local, you know, unbelievably gifted production design department that was able to find us and make belong these incredible practical locations really they were incredible for us when we would go and see like the location where they interview where the tributes are interviewed by their mentors, that building in Leipzig, you know, it looks like you built it. But you're never going to find those locations anywhere but a place like this. And having, say, this incredible local talent, our crew, it was thrilling, and it's why you go to the movies. Is you want to go someplace you haven't been before. You want to be transported, and it feels different when they're real places than when they're green screen.
Let's do one last gamble before we run out of time, and I get kicked out of the room. That's what they usually do. But I should stop talking. Let's do one last gamble. Since Michael Douglas, being Gordon Gekko, we know greed is good.
Yeah.
So let's imagine the Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes goes right through the roof, and fans still want more Panem. What's in the cupboard? What aces do you have in your sleeves?
We don't know. I mean, honestly, it all comes from Suzanne. We said it at the end of the Mockingjay movies. You know, we all got asked, would we do it again? And we all said, you know, if Suzanne wrote another book, I think we'd be in. And I think it's still the truth, you know. So hopefully we'll get that surprise call one day that she's got a new book for us to read. You know, because we love working together and love making, you know, movies in this world, but it's got to come from her.
Yeah, maybe hers is the only sleeve that matters.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe it's going to be the musical, like District 12 Side Story. Right. With more music and more singing, maybe. Right. We're going to see. We cross our fingers. You guys go to the movies and see The Hunger Games, The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes. It's out now. Thank you very much, Nina Jacobson and Francis Lawrence. And may the odds be in your favor.
Thank you very much.
Die Tribute von Panem, The Ballad of Snowbirds and Snakes, ist ab morgen, also ab Donnerstag im Kino. Da ist auch Cat Person, die Verfilmung einer Kurzgeschichte, die vor 6 Jahren, nämlich 2017, im The New Yorker erschienen ist und da auch einen ziemlichen Hype ausgelöst hat. Monatelang stark und leidenschaftlich diskutiert wurde von allen, nicht nur in New York. Die Geschichte von Kristen Rupinian ist eine Geschichte, ja, ein bisschen auf dem Höhepunkt von MeToo über eine junge College-Studentin, die einen älteren Mann datet, der vielleicht oder vielleicht auch nicht ein Creep sein könnte. Ich habe mit der Regisseurin gesprochen, mit Susanna Vogler. Die war unter anderem schon am Drehbuch zu Olivia Wildes Booksmart beteiligt.
Ich nehme eine große Portion Popcorn und Red Wines.
Das ist eine ungewöhnliche Wahl.
Danke.
Aber erstmal natürlich müssen wir über den Film reden. Ne? Aus cineastischer Sicht fängt der erstmal wunderbar an. Wir sind an einem Kino an der Kasse. Da habe ich auch lange gearbeitet. Und ich finde ja auch, das ist einer der schönsten Orte überhaupt, um jemanden kennenzulernen. Also nicht fürs erste Date, sondern wirklich kennenlernen. Zum ersten Mal sehen, zum ersten Mal in Kontakt kommen, wie Margot, Kartenverkäuferin in einem kleinen Programmkino und Filmliebhaber Robert. Sie ist Anfang 20, er Mitte 30. Die kommen ins Gespräch über die Snackauswahl. Er kommt immer wieder und irgendwann fragt er sie nach seiner Nummer. Sie fühlt sich geschmeichelt, lässt sich trotz der Warnung ihrer Mitbewohnerin Taylor auf ein Date ein.
Du hast gar nicht gesagt, wo er studiert.
Er arbeitet sicher. Und er hat Katzen. Er hat schöne Augen und Lachfältchen.
Ja, weil er alt ist.
Das ist schon eine moderne Dating-Geschichte, die wir hier präsentiert bekommen. Eine Geschichte aus der Perspektive einer jungen Frau, die unsicher ist, die verletzbar ist, verletzlich. Und es geht auch um toxische Männlichkeit, um moderne Dating-Kultur, um Stalking, um den Altersunterschied der beiden. Also was kann Margot Robert glauben? Wie ernst meint er seine Nachrichten? Und ist er wirklich der, für den er sich ausgibt?
Waren wenigstens seine Katzen süß?
Die habe ich gar nicht gesehen.
Oh oh.
Wieso sollte er vorgeben, dass er Katzen hat?
Weil ein Typ mit Katzen nicht bedrohlich wirkt. Er wirkt harmlos. Er versteckt was.
Das Ganze beginnt tatsächlich wie eine romantische Liebeskomödie und kippt dann im letzten Drittel, denn Robert verfolgt Margot, schreibt ihr Nachrichten, sie versucht ihm aus dem Weg zu gehen, erfolglos. Und die Regisseurin Susanna Vogel, die inszeniert das so ein bisschen als wilden Genre-Mix. Die spielt mit surrealen Elementen, in denen Margot sich vorstellt, was alles passieren könnte. Das ist so eine Art bebilderter innerer Monolog, der Richtung Horrorfilm abdriftet mit einer großartigen Sexszene. Großartig, weil sie großartig awkward ist. Und genau darüber habe ich auch mit Susanna Vogel gesprochen. Also später. Ich wollte jetzt nicht mit der Tür ins Haus fallen, sondern habe angefangen mit der Genese der Geschichte, wann sie den New Yorker in der Hand hatte und diese Geschichte gelesen hat.
I stumbled on the story because it was sort of thrust into the public eye when it was published in the New Yorker in 2017. And people were all talking about it. Everyone was really worked up about it. And I opened the story expecting some really explosive, controversial plot. And instead, I just found this incredibly intimate, well-observed sort of journalistic piece of fiction that I was shocked that it was so controversial. And then the controversy around it became really interesting to me. Like, what is it about this that gets under people's skin? What is this allowing people to think and talk about that they don't normally get a chance to think and talk about? And then when I read Michelle Ashford's adaptation of the script of the short story, I felt like this has the potential to really tap into an experience that's deeply personal to so many women and also kind of touch on their psychology in an elevated way that plays with genre in a way that could sort of bring men into the conversation too. And so, you know, but men and women were so vocal about the story that it felt like it had to be told, a story that had to be told.
But why do you think do men in particular react as they react reading the story and watching your film?
Honestly, I think that men are sensitive. I think that we talk about how sensitive women are all the time, but we're so used to dealing with being invalidated that by the time we're adults, we're like tough in a way, like we have our defenses up. And I think men are actually less used to being looking in the mirror in that way, you know, from a woman's perspective, it feels like an affront to them and their self. And I think male sensitivity is part of what the movie's about and Robert's story is about. And male sensitivity was a huge part of why the story was so explosive too. And it's something that I think needs to be talked about more, not so that we placate and coddle men, but so that they can have a voice and have their experience, but also so that we can look at how at how their sensitivity leads to anger sometimes, and how that anger can end up being pretty toxic and violent in other times.
You just mentioned it. Your film has another ending than the story, and without giving away too much, why did you change? Why did you sort of add another chapter to the film adaptation?
There were two reasons. One was that the story is from Margot's perspective entirely. It doesn't give Robert a perspective. It's not about him. It's about Margot. And Robert is introduced to us, the audience, entirely through Margot's descriptions. And we're left to project whatever Robert we want into that story. But actually the medium of film is different. There's a real person there. And that real person is played by a real actor who's asking me questions like, why did I say that? Why did I do that? What did I mean by that? What in my background made me say that to her in that way? And so as you're building out the humanity of that character in order to like answer for that, you've come up with, you end up with a dimensional person. You end up wanting to give that person an interior life. And it feels like the sophisticated way to tell the story is actually to acknowledge his argument there, even if you don't forgive anything he does, that he has a perspective too, and that it's a dance these two people are doing, and that they're both part of, even if, you know, he is more problematic than she is, and you know, his story may or may not be sympathetic. So I think that's a part of it. And the other part of it that we wanted to tap into is honestly the anger around the story felt like it was reflecting a psychology in the culture that then felt like it needed to be part of the movie. So like showing how angry men got at the story felt like, okay, those men are Robert. Like Robert is a man who would react that way to the story Cat Person. Robert would read Cat Person and think that Robert was maligned by the woman. So the way these men are acting and reacting feels relevant to Robert's side. And so we felt like we wanted to have a chapter that acknowledged that, you know?
Diving into the story and diving into the topic of online dating and male-female behavior, in which ways did it change your perspective on online dating?
I mean, Robert and Margot do meet in person, so they're not it's not a story about two people who don't meet until they've projected. They do meet, but in terms of like the use of phones and the way that it's complicated connections, I think we're in a confusing place in culture where there's more language to talk about problems. Like we have words like gaslighting, toxic masculinity, mansplaining. Like these are words in the culture that we can use to talk about things that didn't have words before. But at the same time, there's less connecting with the actual person than there was before. There's more projecting, and there's more of an opportunity to have a narrative in your head about somebody because you're communicating with them so much on your phone. And the relationship you have with the texts that come in on your phone when you're in your pajamas, comfortable in your house, is so different from how you feel being in someone's physical space that one doesn't necessarily lead you to feel comfortable in the other. And you can text somebody for weeks and weeks. It doesn't mean that when you're with them, you feel safe to open up to them or sleep with them. So it's like this disconnect that's worse than it was before, even though we have more language to talk about what's uncomfortable about it, you know?
Everyone has weird dating stories, especially in real life and especially in big cities. Like I'm living in Berlin and everyone comes up with this really crazy stories. How did you talk on set about the dating conversation?
I mean, it's impossible to talk about this movie with cast and crew without getting personal. Everybody just brings up their own connection to the story, which is to say their own past. So, or their friends' stories. It's such a bonding experience to talk about the trials and tribulations of dating and intimacy that everyone sort of did. That was really communal, you know, like talking about what's complicated about this dynamic. We're always referencing their own stories, and it felt really natural. It felt like that's what this story brings out in people. It's like it sort of provokes their memory bank of experiences in a way that I think is useful, because sometimes that leads to them processing something in a different way or seeing a different side, which is important.
It's a sort of a wild genre mix. It starts as a romantic comedy and it sort of turns into a horror film. How did you come up with it, with this wild genre mix?
It was baked into the screenplay, and it was something I really loved about the screenplay was that, and something that Kristen says about the short story, which is really that Margot's trying to figure out what genre of movie she's in as a person, you know, like she gets up, she goes about her day, she meets a guy. She's seen a lot of movies where boy meets girl and that leads to happily ever after. So she's like, is it that? But then sometimes she feels fear. And then she's like, but wait, I've also seen movies where the girl gets killed. Is it that? You know, she's trying to figure out what it is. The information she's getting from this guy is not fitting neatly into any of those boxes. And so her mind is kind of running away with her in a way that is like very understandable given kind of what women carry around all the time. And also the fact that she wants to connect with somebody, but it's very vulnerable to do that at any age. And especially when you're so aware of like victim narratives that women have, whether or not it applies to you, your brain wonders, you know, like it's like friends texting each other before they go out on dates. Like, if I'm not back by this time, like this is the address I'll be at. And, you know, call 911, blah, blah, blah. It's like, that's real. You know, it's real that people are like, I'm taking a leap, but actually the stakes are so high. If this could be a really bad situation and I will need help, you know? So that's all part of being a woman and dating, you know?
There's a lot of internal monologue, her sort of violent visions she has about Robert, for example. What was for you the challenge adapting this to the screen?
We tried to just put that monologue into like intrusive thoughts that she has. So it's showing as she walks through her day, she's constantly hijacked by different thoughts or fears. And so we tried to just take a sort of cue from the story and put those in visual terms, whether that's that she, you know, imagines Robert doing horrible things, or she's in a speeding car, or she imagines him in all these scenarios. So we just tried to sort of like show it. But I also think we tried to use surrealism to do that as well, like in the sex scene where she's talking to herself. And that's a way that you can sort of play with the idea of an internal monologue without having a voiceover.
You just mentioned the sex scene. I think we have to talk about this very weird, intense, bad sex scene. I think every woman knows about it. Can you talk a little bit how you achieved the scene, especially with the cast and crew?
I've directed 3 sex scenes in different projects, and it's always a little different. And this is by far the most kind of graphic one, even though there's no nudity in it. It's sort of just an unedited, unbroken bad experience from start to finish. And the claustrophobia of that was something we wanted to capture, but also there were other components that we wanted to make sure felt really unique. Like, we didn't want to have any nudity in it because we didn't want people to feel like they had something to look at that was anything but horrifying. And so we kept them sort of trapped in her perspective, and to have nudity, I think, would have like allowed people to look at something in a male gaze way that would have been like a break from the stress of the scene that we didn't want, because she can't get out of it. So we also wanted to trap the viewer in it. But it's procedural. It's like you plan everything out so intensely, especially these days with intimacy coordinators, making sure that women feel comfortable shooting stuff like that. You know, we talked about it, we storyboarded it, we had meeting after meeting, the actors approved everything. By the time we got there, we knew what we were doing, and we were comfortable enough to do it. And we trusted each other enough to sort of to trust each other's answers when we were saying, are you okay? How's this going? Are you cool? Whatever. And I think part of that was really buoyed by the fact that the crew was real. Everybody who made this movie was had a connection in some way to the material, like to the content, you know, to the themes. And so everybody ended up confessing their bad sex stories along the way. So by the time we were making the scene, like, we all felt like we were making something special and relatable and important and kind of speaking for the collective. And that, I think, also helped it feel like it wasn't some exploitative thing. It was like, we all felt like this scene is going to have an impact on people because it's having an impact on our crew. And that, I think, helped it feel like we could see the bigger picture to it, you know?
We are living in 2023, and there are still very few female-driven stories with a vulnerable perspective. Do you feel a change, or what would you say does it need to have more stories like Cat Person being told on the big screen?
Well, I think there's a bit of misguided, like, pseudo-feminist filmmaking where the woman is just a strong female character in the most two-dimensional sense of the word, where, like, the woman is conducting herself like she has no vulnerability, and that sort of passes for feminism because she's taking the male role, the traditionally male role. And I think those movies are not, I don't know that that's better for feminism. I think we need all versions of things. So we can still have like the female Terminator, but then we need a movie where, you know, there's a woman who is strong, but also has feelings. You know, it can't be a binary where women are either devoid of vulnerability or they're victims. because actually most people are neither. They're both, you know. I think we just need more stories, and we need fewer mandates about what makes a movie feminist. We just need more stories about women, you know. I've had male executives on calls ask, like, tell me that the woman has to be strong all the time or else it's not feminist. And I'm like, well, why don't you ask the three women on the Zoom what they want? You know, why are you the arbiter of what's feminist? And I think sometimes it's a misguided attempt to fix the problem, but it actually just creates a different cliche.
Thank you. It was great talking to you.
Thank you so much.
Cat Person ist sehr sehenswert, wie ich finde, ab Donnerstag im Kino. Und da ist noch ein Film, dessen Titel wir alle schon mal gehört haben, als wir im Westen nichts Neues bei den Oscars in diesem Jahr die Daumen gedrückt haben. Der war nämlich auch für einen Oscar nominiert als bester nicht englischsprachiger Film. Der Film The Quiet Girl aus Irland. Jetzt könnt ihr zu Recht sagen, Moment mal, irischer Film nominiert als bester nicht englischsprachiger Film, was soll das denn? Ja, ganz einfach, der Film ist nicht auf Englisch gedreht, sondern auf Irisch, also auf Gälisch. Und ich habe es tatsächlich einmal probiert, den Film ohne Untertitel zu gucken. Ich bin kläglich gescheitert. Keine Chance, auch nur ansatzweise irgendwas zu verstehen, auch wenn gar nicht so viel gesprochen wird. Es ist ein ganz ruhiger Film. Es geht um Kate, das ist ein junges Mädchen. Ein sehr ruhiges junges Mädchen, die kommt aus nicht ganz einfachen Verhältnissen. Die Mutter ist überfordert, hochschwanger, zum wievielten Mal, weiß ich gar nicht. Der Vater ist ein Trinker und Kate überlebt zu Hause nur, weil sie sich angewöhnt hat, unauffällig zu sein. Ne? Also nicht auffallen, das schützt vor Schlägen. Und kurz vor der erneuten Niederkunft der Mutter schickt die sie über den Sommer weg zu einer entfernten Cousine und ihrem Mann, zu Ablin und Sean. Das ist ein kinderloses Paar in den 50ern.
Wir haben uns zuletzt gesehen, als du noch im Kinderwagen lagst.
Der ist kaputt gemacht.
Oh, na nun, wie geht denn sowas?
Naja, es fehlt ein Rad, weil meine Schwestern da drin Rennen gefahren sind.
Komm ins Haus, mein Kind.
Und das, finde ich, hört sich auch erstmal an wie so ein Horrorfilm, ist aber überhaupt keiner. Es ist wirklich ein wunderbares Juwel, ein ganz ruhiger, naturnaher, poetischer Film, der wirklich sowas Märchenhaftes hat. Kates Pflegeeltern, die sind nämlich das Gegenteil ihrer leiblichen Eltern. Die sind liebevoll, die sind umsorgend, die sind unfreiwillig kinderlos und keine Spur verbittert. Bei ihnen darf Kate das haben, was ihr zu Hause wirklich verwehrt wird, nämlich eine ganz normale, unbeschwerte Kindheit.
Kannst du denn gut laufen?
Wie?
Na, ob du schnell läufst mit deinen langen Beinen?
Manchmal.
Nun, lauf zum Ende des Wegs und dann zum Kasten und wieder zurück.
Was für ein Kasten?
Zu unserem Postkasten. Ich habe heute vergessen nachzusehen. Ich möchte, dass du für mich guckst. Und los mit dir. Ich stopp die Zeit, dann wissen wir, wie schnell du läufst. Na, los geht's.
Der Film hat so eine Monotonie, die sich durchzieht. Ne? Alles kehrt wieder. Es gibt tägliche Rituale, die Kate helfen, ihr den Sommer über Struktur zu geben. Und diese vermeintliche Monotonie, die spiegelt sich auch in der Inszenierung wieder. Es gibt die immer wiederkehrenden gleichen Bilder, die gleichen Einstellungen, die gleichen Räume, die Küche, das Bad, der Weg zum Brunnen, zum Briefkasten. Und das ist so eine Monotonie, die der Film auch braucht, um sie in der letzten Szene brechen zu können. Denn Kate hat eine unglaubliche Beobachtungsgabe, streuen stundenlang durch die Natur, saugt alles in sich auf. Der Film ist komplett aus ihrer Perspektive erzählt. Die Kamera ist so ein bisschen stellvertretend für ihren Blick, ihr Eintauchen in die Natur. Die Kamera beobachtet mal einfach so minutenlang, oder ja, minutenlang nicht, aber sehr lang, den Verlauf der Wolken, das Schaukeln der Blätter im Wind, das Tropfen des Wassers in dem mysteriösen Brunnen hinterm Haus. Es ist ein Regiedebüt von Colm Barrett und der zieht seine Spannung nicht aus einem Drama, so einer künstlichen Aufregung, sondern wirklich aus der Einfachheit. Zu sagen, er plätschere dahin, wird dem Film in keiner Minute gerecht, das wäre wirklich böse. Es geht einfach um die Gefühlswelt eines kleinen Mädchens, um ihre Erfahrungen und die sind mir wirklich mitten ins Herz gegangen, weil es einfach so, ja, die kleinen Gesten der Liebe sind. Das Zurückstreichen der Haare, das liebevolle Schrubben im Bad, der hingelegte Butterkeks auf dem Küchentisch, ein gehauchtes Daddy und das wird am Ende bleiben und spätestens da, ne? Also wirklich in der Schlussszene wird einem bewusst, was für ein kleines irisches Juwel man da gerade gesehen hat. Auch ab Donnerstag im Kino, geht rein, am besten im Original mit Untertitel und dann einfach sich diesem Film hingeben. So, jetzt habe ich genug alleine gelabert, das Housekeeping hinter mir ist auch fertig. Ich muss los zu Napoleon, den bringe ich nächste Woche mit in Form von Ridley Scott und Joaquin Phoenix. Tom ist bis dahin hoffentlich auch wieder genesen, an dieser Stelle nochmal gute Besserung. Bis dahin, guckt bitte nichts, was wir nicht auch gucken würden. Hauptsache, es flimmert.
Deutschlandfunk Nova. Eine Stunde Film. Jeden Mittwoch neu. Auf deutschlandfunknova.de und überall, wo es Podcasts gibt. Deine Podcasts.